This Writers Centre Norwich podcast was recorded at the 2015 Noirage Crime Writing Festival in partnership with the University of East Anglia and Dead Good Books.
A local charity suddenly realises that they've never received a donation from the town's most prosperous CEO. So one day the chief fundraiser decides to call on him in person in his penthouse to see if she can get him to contribute. Our records indicate that we don't seem to have you on our books at the moment, she intones. You are a renowned public figure and the town's most successful businessman. We were wondering perhaps whether you might like to, give a little something back to the community in some way. The CEO mulls this over for a moment and then smiles. Do your records also show that my mother is fighting a losing battle with cancer, he asks, and that her medical bills are currently several times her annual income? I'm afraid not, mumbles the embarrassed charity worker. I see, says the CEO, that's okay, how about this? Do your records show that my brother, a disabled veteran, is blind and confined to a wheelchair? No, stammers the beleaguered rep. Thought not, says the CEO, his voice rising in indignation. Well, okay, let's try this then. Do your records show that my sister lost her husband in a car accident several years ago, leaving her penniless and with three children? I'm so sorry, whispers the horrified fundraiser. I had absolutely no idea. The CEO shakes his head. I'm sure you didn't, he yells. So let me ask you this. If I don't give any money to them, why the hell should I give anything to you? Deep in the neurobiological cosmos, the brain of the psychopath is glimpsed in remote orbit. A moonless world of glacial desolation and eerie mathematical charm. No sooner is the word out than images of mad, reclusive bombers, one-eyed Taliban warlords, serial killers, rapists, Democrats, Republicans and Papists come scything across the badlands of our minds. But what if I were to paint you a different picture? What if I were to tell you that the arsonist who burns your house down might also, in a parallel universe, be the hero most likely to brave the flaming timbers of a crumbling, blazing building to seek out and drag out your loved ones? Or that the kid wielding a knife in the shadows at the back of a movie theatre might also in years to come be wielding a rather different kind of knife at the back of a rather different kind of theatre. Or that the super cool financial assassin, the shadowy ambassador of charm whose mentholated morals and lightning sleight of mind robbed you blind of your entire life savings, might also, were to put his own mind to it, be the person most likely to save your business from going under. Now, claims like these stretch credulity to the limit, and yet they're true. Unlike their box office counterparts, not all psychopaths are violent. Far from it, in fact. Merciless and fearless, maybe, but violence is on a different neural freeway, one which sometimes has an interchange with psychopathy, but which just as often passes overhead. To see what I mean, take a look at the following simple grid. Let's start top right and work our way clockwise. Let's say that you are a psychopath, that you get a poor start in life, that you are low in intelligence, and that you are also dispositionally violent. Well, your prospects, to be perfectly honest, folks, aren't exactly great. You're going to wind up as a low-level thug or an enforcer for a criminal gang, something along those lines. Either way, you're going to end up in prison pretty quickly. Remove violence from the equation and your prospects a little better. You're going to be a crook, small-time con artist, drug dealer or pimp, or more likely than not, all four in combination. And once again, you're going to end up in prison pretty sharpish. But now let's say that you're a psychopath, that you are not naturally violent, that you get a good start in life, and that you're intelligent. Now it's a different story altogether. Now, as the famous Reuters headline once put it, you're more likely going to make a killing in the market than anywhere else. Finally, if you're a psychopath, intelligent and violent, well, any number of exotic occupations might await you, anything from special forces operative to the head of a criminal syndicate. To give you an idea of what I'm talking about, in 2011, I launched something called the Great British Psychopath Survey. Now, the survey is unique, the first of its kind to assess the prevalence of psychopathic traits across an entire national workforce. So participants were directed onto my website, where they completed something called the Levinson Self-Report Scale of Psychopathy, and were then given their score. But that wasn't all. They also entered their employment details. So what would turn out to be the UK's most psychopathic profession, I wondered, and for that matter, its least? Well, the results, as you can see up on the screen behind me here, folks, certainly make interesting reading, especially if you're partial to a sermon or two on a Sunday. You can see that the church, the clergy, managed to squeeze in there at number nine. The irony is plain as day. Guys like these, through some fiendish trick of nature, possess the very personality characteristics that the rest of us would die for. Indeed, that some who've fallen under the spell of the psychopath have died for. They possess immense poise under pressure, their refrigerated hearts barely skipping a beat under conditions of even the gravest danger. They are charming, charismatic, confident, ruthless, and remorseless. So, having heard all that, do you think you might actually know one? Indeed, might you be one yourself? So we're going to find out, folks, if we've got any psychopaths in the house this evening. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put up a little questionnaire here on the screen. So what I want you to do is I want you to get out your mobile phone or a piece of paper or something, because you're going to have to score how you rate on these questions, all right? And I'm going to read them out just so in case some of the people in the back row there can't see them. First of all, what you've got to remember is this. There's a little scoring key. So these 11 statements that I'm going to read out to you all hypothetically describe you, okay? If you strongly disagree that the statement describes you, award yourself 0 points for that item. If you disagree, award yourself 1 point. If you agree, award yourself 2 points. And if you strongly agree, award yourself 2 points. And if you strongly agree, give yourself 3. So strongly disagree, 0. Disagree, 1. Agree, 2. Strongly agree, 3. All right? And I'll read them out. Number 1. I rarely plan ahead. I'm a spur of the moment kind of person. I rarely plan ahead. I'm a spur of the moment kind of person. So, 0 if you strongly disagree with that, 3 if you strongly agree, and 1 and 2 in between. Number 2. Cheating on your partner is okay as long as you don't get caught. That's the one, wherever I do that at Oxford University, that's the one where all the students like look over their shoulders at the person next to them, see what they're writing down. Got my eyes on you. Number 3. If something better comes along, it's okay to cancel a long-standing appointment. Number 4. Seeing an animal injured or in pain doesn't bother me in the slightest. Number 5. Driving fast cars, riding roller coasters, and skydiving appeal to me. Number 6. It doesn't matter to me if I have to step on others to get what I want. A few people shaking their heads already, actually. Number 7. I'm very persuasive. I have a talent for getting others to do what I want. Number 8. I'd be good in a dangerous job because I can make my mind up quickly. Number 9. I find it easy to keep it together when others are cracking under pressure. Number 10. If you're able to con someone, that's their problem. They deserve it. And number 11. The last one. Most of the time, when things go wrong, it's someone else's fault, not mine. All right, folks, so you should have 11 numbers on the page or screen in front of you. What I want you to do is I want you to chop them up, and then we'll come back to that a little bit later on, okay? So let's get one thing straight right from the start, shall we? Being a psychopath, as we've just seen, doesn't automatically mean you're a criminal. Not by default, at any rate. And it doesn't mean you're a serial killer either. In fact, a heck of a lot of psychopaths aren't even in prison. They're out there, if you remember number 7 from our survey, police officers banging other people up. Now, this may come as a surprise to too many of you, but it's true. Rather like these scoring rings on a shooting target, there are in fact inner and outer zones of psychopathy, with only a tiny minority falling within the bullseye. Psychopathy is on a spectrum along which each of us have our place, and like any scale or dimension, it's going to have its A-listers. Now, the assumption that there exists a big fat dividing line between psychopath and non-psychopath is descended from the lineage of clinical diagnosis, more often than not within a forensic setting, using standardised psychometric tests. The psychopathy checklist, for instance, is an established, well-validated questionnaire originally developed by the Canadian psychologist Robert Hare for use exclusively within clinical settings, and measures core psychopathic traits such as charm, persuasiveness, fearlessness, and the absence of conscience and empathy. On its 40-point scale, most normal members of the population typically register around 1 or 2, whereas the entry level for psychopaths is generally considered to be 30. Now, within forensic settings, as indicated by their performance on the psychopathy checklist, hole-in-one psychopaths, as I call them, are way, way ahead at the top of the leaderboard. There is no question a world of difference between these guys and the rest of us. But the problem, of course, is that not all of us live within clinical settings. And while Hannibal Lecter here is serving up liver for breakfast, the personality characteristics that separate out these, what we might call pure psychopaths from the rest of us, just so happen, like any other personality characteristic, to be evenly distributed across the general population as a whole. Just as there exists no official dividing line between someone who plays the piano and a concert pianist, for instance, or between someone who plays tennis and, say, an Andy Murray or a Roger Federer, so the frontier between a world-class psychopath and someone who merely psychopathises is similarly blurred. Think about it. One individual, for example, might be ruthless, fearless, and demonstrate a sublime lack of empathy, but might at the same time act neither violently, antisocially, nor without conscience. High on three psychopathic characteristics, such an individual might rightfully be considered further along the psychopathic spectrum than someone scoring low on those three traits, who wouldn't come anywhere near the danger zone of someone scoring high on all of them. Now, supporters of this dimensional take on psychopathy, that the core characteristics of the disorder are like the dials on a studio mixing desk, which can be twiddled up and down in various combinations, have, just like the clinicians, their own psychometric divining rod of choice, the Psychopathic Personality Inventory, or PPI for short. Developed by the American psychologist Scott Lilienfeld, the PPI represents a more nuanced detector of psychopathic traits, in direct contrast to its predecessor, the psychopathy checklist, was designed for use within non-clinical settings, on you and me, for instance. Lilienfeld's monster test, the inventory, consists of a grand total of 187 questions, so you'd be glad we won't be doing that one here this evening, boasts 8 dials on its own particular mixing desk, which you can see up on the screen behind me here. These 8 independent satellite states of the psychopathic personality divide and reform along 3 superordinate axes: self-centred impulsivity, fearless dominance, and emotional detachment, to reveal a 3-dimensional model of psychopathic space. But note, and this is important, folks, that one's overall score on the PPI may be reached in different ways. So just as 2 athletes, for instance, might post the same overall points total at the end of, say, a decathlon, yet exhibit completely different performance profiles over the course of the 10 events, so might 2 individuals post the same overall score on the PPI, have the same volume output level on the mixing desk, but output in different ways. Now, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out where this one's heading. Crank all of those dials on the mixing desk up to max and have that as your default setting, and you overload the circuit. You wind up getting 30 years inside. But turn some up high and some down low depending on the circumstances, become, as it were, a method psychopath, and you'll be ripping it up in a different way to the Dahmers and the Sutcliffes and the Bundys. Which means, of course, that we've got some fuzzy logic in the house, because while on the one hand we're unable to delineate the definitive psychopathic personality, what we are able to do, on the other hand, is flag up different psychopathic personalities. Think of it, if you like, in terms of national identity. So Cockneys and Mancunians are both English, right? But is one more English than the other? Well, second thought, perhaps maybe don't answer that question. Which begs, of course, an even more fundamental question. Of these myriad psychopathic multiverses, might there actually be one with the optimal conditions for success? Might there be a winning variety? $8.99 from Amazon, all right? Okay, folks. The question of what it takes to succeed in a given profession is not, when it comes down to it, all that difficult. Alongside the specialised skill set necessary to do the job, there exists, from surgery to politics, from advocacy to IT, a constellation of traits which serve as a kind of psychological booster rocket. Business is no exception. And here it turns out certain psychopathic characteristics really do, it would seem, appear to come into their own. Several years ago, a team of psychologists from the University of Surrey conducted a bizarre experiment. They pitted a bunch of top business executives against a bunch of hospitalised criminals from a maximum security unit on a test similar to the PPI, and compared their responses. What they discovered was extraordinary. A range of psychopathic characteristics, charm, egocentricity, persuasiveness, lack of empathy and focus, were actually more common among the executives than the executioners. Where the difference between the two groups did show up was when it came to the more overtly antisocial manifestations of psychopathy. So here, unsurprisingly, perhaps the executioners did come out on top, posting high readings on criminal behaviour and physical aggressiveness, and lower readings, respectively, on discipline and self-control. And that's not all. A recent study examining the personality profiles of so-called hero populations, those who work in law enforcement, the military and the rescue services, for instance, paints a similar picture. Fearlessness, social dominance and stress immunity dials are all turned up to the right, whereas antisocial, narcissism and impulsivity dials are contrastingly turned to the left. Further evidence of the benefit of psychopathic characteristics in the boardroom comes from work carried out by the Canadian psychologist Bob Hare, who I mentioned to you a few moments ago. Hare handed out his psychopathy checklist to over 200 top US business executives and compared the prevalence of psychopathic traits within the corporate community to that found within the general population at large. The results, not to put too fine a point on it, folks, certainly proved an eye-opener. Not only did the execs come out on top, but psychopathy was positively associated with in-house ratings of creativity and communication skill, with good strategic thinking, creativity, and the ability to persuade. And also, if the results of another recent study are anything to go by, with the ability not just to tolerate risk, but to thrive on it. Now, the study I'm going to tell you about takes the form of a gambling game consisting of 20 rounds. At the beginning of the game, each participant was handed a roll of $20 bills, and at the start of each new round was asked whether they were prepared to risk the princely sum of $1 on the toss of a coin. Now, a loss incurred the penalty of that $1 invested, whereas a win swelled the coffers by a cool $2.50. Now, it doesn't take a genius to work out the winning formula. Logically, as someone pointed out, the right thing to do is to invest in every round. But logic, as someone else once rather sagely pointed out, is often in the eye of the logician. So prior to the experiment, participants were divided up into two groups, those with lesions or damage in the emotion areas of their brains and those with lesions in other areas. Now, if, as neuroeconomic theory suggests, it's an overdose of emotion that is responsible for unnecessary risk aversion, then according to the dynamics of the game, those participants with the relevant presenting pathology, in other words, those in the first group, should clean up. They should outperform those without, in other words, those in the second group. Surprise, surprise, folks, that was exactly how the study panned out. As the game unfolded, normal participants began declining the opportunity to gamble, preferring instead to conserve their winnings. But participants with problems in their brain's emotion neighbourhoods, participants whose brains were not equipped with the fitted as standard everyday emotional seatbelts that the rest of us take for granted, just kept on rolling and ended the game with a significantly higher profit margin than their competitors. This may be the first study, comments one of the authors, that documents a situation in which people with brain damage make better financial decisions than normal people. A colleague goes one better. Research needs to determine the circumstances in which emotions can be useful or disruptive, in which they can be a guide for human behaviour. The most successful stockbrokers might plausibly be termed functional psychopaths, individuals who, on the one hand, are either more adept at controlling their emotions, or who, on the other, do not experience them to the same degree of intensity as others. Many CEOs, he adds rather unnervingly, and many top lawyers might also share this trait. Food for thought. Now, of course, as well as making a killing in the market, folks, psychopaths have also been known to kill elsewhere. In 2009, 20 years after Ted Bundy here's execution in Florida State Prison, a team of Canadian researchers decided to take this icy American serial killer at his word. During an interview, Bundy, who, in case you didn't know, smashed in the skulls of 35 women over a four-year period during the mid-1970s, had confided to police that he could tell a good victim simply from the way she walked. "I'm the coldest son of a bitch you'll ever meet," Bundy once said. No one could fault him there. But might he, the researchers wondered, also have been one of the shrewdest? To find out, they set up an ingenious experiment. First, they recruited 12 women, six of whom had suffered a previous traumatic attack, and six of whom hadn't. Secondly, they videotaped these women walking along a corridor. Thirdly, they then presented these 12 videotape segments to a bunch of students on the one hand and to a bunch of psychopaths housed within the confines of a supermax prison on the other, and asked them quite simply to figure out who was who, which of the 12 women had been attacked and which hadn't. Now, the rationale was simple. If Bundy's assertion held water, and he really had been able to sniff out weakness from the way his victims walked, then the psychopath should be better at decoding vulnerability than the students. That, it turned out, folks, was precisely what the researchers uncovered. Now, findings like these are no flash in the pan. In fact, this study is one of just a growing number that have in recent years begun to show the psychopath in a new, more complex light. A light completely different to the lurid shadows cast by newspaper headlines and Hollywood scriptwriters, and oddly adaptive kind of light. In the same year, for instance, the results of this experiment were published, I decided to perform my own take on it. So if, as had been found, psychopaths really were better at zoning in on vulnerability, then there had to be applications. There had to be ways in which, rather than being a drain on society, they actually conferred some benefit. So enlightenment dawned when I was meeting a friend at the airport. Now, we all get a little bit, paranoid going through customs, I mused, even when we're perfectly innocent. But imagine how it would feel if we did have something to hide. So 30 undergraduate students took part in my experiment, half of them scoring high on psychopathic characteristics and half of them scoring low. There were also five associates, or helpers, my evil co-conspirators in the plot. Now, the students' job was easy. They had to sit in a classroom and observe the associates' movements as they entered through one door and exited through another, traversing en route a small elevated stage. But that wasn't all. There was also a little catch. They also had to note who was guilty. Which of the five associates was concealing a scarlet handkerchief? Now, to raise the stakes and give them something to go on, the associate in question was handed £100. Now, if the jury decided that they were the guilty party, when the votes were counted, they came out on top, then they had to give it back. But if, on the other hand, they got away with it, if the finger of suspicion fell more heavily on one of the other four, then they would, in contrast, stand to be rewarded. They would instead get to keep the £100. Now, the nerves were certainly jangling when the associates made their entrance, but which of the students would make the better customs officials? Would the psychopath's predatory instincts prove reliable, or would their nose for vulnerability let them down? Well, the results, folks, were extraordinary. Over 70% of the students scoring high on psychopathic characteristics correctly identified the handkerchief smuggling associate, compared to just 30% of the low scorers. So zeroing in on weakness may well be part of the serial killer's toolkit, but hey, it can also come in handy at the airport. In fact, folks, there's evidence to suggest that as well as being better than the rest of us at zoning in on subtle aspects of body language, psychopaths are actually more observant across the board and possess higher concentration levels in general than the wider population at large. Let me give an example of what I'm talking about here. Do you remember that spot the difference game you used to play as kids, the one where you got the two pictures side by side and you have to pick out the differences between? You remember that? Well, what I'm going to show you now is similar to that, except for the fact that instead of the two pictures appearing side by side, what I'm going to do is I'm going to present them to you one after the other in rapid succession, okay? And your job is to stick your hand up as soon as you notice the glaring difference between them, the one glaring difference between the pictures. You got it? Okay, let's go. Okay. As soon as you spot the difference between those two pictures, stick your hand up. And once again, got one in the front row there. Once again, it's absolutely pretty unmissable once you know what it is. Guy here. Few hands. Okay, let's pause it. Okay, mate, what do you reckon it is?
The engine.
Let's have a look. The engine is appearing and disappearing in the middle of the plane. Hands up, who got that right again? Let's see. Not bad. Okay, that's more than before. let's do another one. Okay, so same thing again, slightly more difficult this time. Put your hand up again as soon as you spot the difference between the two pictures. Okay. Few hands. Slightly more difficult, I think, this one. Okay. Okay. Let's stop it. Lady in the front row there, what do you think it was?
The row behind them was either higher or lower.
Correct. Let's have another look. The rail behind the diners is going up and down. Well done. How many people have got 2 out of 2? Not too many. We'll find out in a minute. Not too many. We'll do one more. Again, just slightly more difficult, probably the most difficult one of all. Stick your hand up as soon as you get it. Any take? Is someone over there?
Background of Madison, whoever it is.
That's right. Okay, so let's just have a look. The background behind the face is going from light to dark. Did anybody get 3 out of 3? No, I can't see at the back there. Very rare to get 3 out of 3. Okay, folks, do you remember our little psychopath quiz of earlier? Don't worry, I haven't forgotten it. Let's score it now, shall we? So this is a moment of truth time. So let's have a show of hands. How many people scored 0 to 11? What a nice bunch you are. What a nice bunch. 0 to 11 is low. Low. All right, how many people scored 12 to 17. Wow, that's pretty much all of it, I think, now. 12 to 17, below average. Any takers for 18 to 22? Average. You can feel the tension rising. How many people scored 23 to 28? Everyone starting to turn round. 23 to 28, a few takers there over on the, a few more on the left there. How many people, that's high by the way, how many people scored 29 to 33? Very high. It's also very rare. And now everyone's turning around now. No one's behind them. Very rare. Okay, folks, now let me just tell you, we're not diagnosing anyone here this evening, all right? This is just a general indication of where you might be on the psychopathic spectrum, all right? Okay, folks, I was telling you a few moments ago about the psychopath's finely tuned vulnerability antennae, about their enhanced killer instinct. But it might surprise you to know that there are some situations in which psychopaths are actually more adept at saving lives than they are at taking them. Let me give you an example of what I'm talking about here. Consider the following conundrum. Let's call it case one. A train is hurtling down a track. In its path, five people are trapped on the line and cannot escape. Now, fortunately, you can flick a switch which diverts the train down a fork in that track away from the five people, but at a price. There is another person trapped down that fork, and the train will kill them instead. Question: should you flick the switch? Now, most people have little trouble deciding what to do under those circumstances. Though the thought of flicking the switch isn't exactly a nice one, the utilitarian choice, killing just the one person instead of the five, represents the least worst option. Agreed? Okay. Well, now let's consider the following variation, case two. As before, a train is speeding out of control down a track towards five people, but this time you are standing behind a very large stranger on a footbridge above the tracks. Now, the only way to save the people is to heave the stranger over. They will fall to a certain death, but their considerable bulk will block the train, saving five lives. Question: should you push them? What do you mean, yeah? Oh, what did you score? Now, folks, we've got a real dilemma on our hands. While the score in lives is precisely the same as in the first scenario, 5-1, one's choice of action appears far trickier. But why should this be? Well, the reason, it turns out, all boils down to temperature. Case one represents what we might call an impersonal dilemma. It involves those areas of the brain, the prefrontal cortex and posterior parietal cortex, in particular the anterior parasingulate cortex, temporal pole and superior temporal sulcus, primarily responsible for what we term cold empathy, for reasoning and rational thought. Case two, on the other hand, represents what we might call a personal dilemma. It involves the emotion area of the brain known as the amygdala, the circuitry of what we term hot empathy, the feeling of feeling what another person is feeling. Now, psychopaths, just like most normal members of the general population, have no trouble at all with case one. They flick the switch and the train diverts accordingly, killing just the one person instead of the five. But, and here is where it starts to get interesting, psychopaths, quite unlike most normal members of the general population, also experience little difficulty with case two. Psychopaths, without a moment's hesitation, are perfectly happy to chuck the fat guy over the rails if that's what the doctor orders. Moreover, this difference in behaviour has a distinct neural signature. The pattern of brain activation in both psychopaths and normal people is identical on the presentation of impersonal moral dilemmas, but radically different when things start to get a bit more personal. Imagine, for instance, that I were to hook you up to a brain scanner, a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, and were then to present you with the two dilemmas. What would I observe as you went about trying to solve them? Well, at the precise moment that the nature of the dilemma switches from impersonal to personal, I would notice the emotion area of your brain, your amygdala, and related brain circuits, your medial orbital frontal cortex, for example, light up like a pinball machine. I would witness the moment, in other words, when emotion puts its money in the slot. But in psychopaths, I would see nothing. The cavernous neural casino would remain in darkness, and the passage from impersonal to personal would slip by unnoticed. Okay, folks, just got my eye on the time here a little bit. In our books, that we've got out at the moment. We unveil what we call a psychopath manifesto. So there are various kinds of characteristics that we can learn from people who are on the psychopathic spectrum to make ourselves a little bit more efficient, a little bit more assertive, a little bit more successful in our lives. I'm not going to go through all of them. I'm going to pick one of these because we can end with a rather interesting little experiment. I'm going to pick study people. Now, one of the things that we know about psychopaths is they are brilliant manipulators and persuaders. And they also have, related to that, a rather remarkable trait, a rather remarkable ability. And it's the ability to tell apart truth-tellers from liars. They're way better than the rest of us at being able to do this. Now, we don't really know why that is, but we have a few hunches. Whenever we tell a lie, our faces actually have a lie configuration. There's a loads and loads of different small muscles in the face. And when we tell a lie, the face puts on this kind of picture very, very fleetingly. It's a lightning-fast change in facial scenery that lasts probably around about 500 milliseconds that is invisible to most people's naked eyes. But because psychopaths, when you are interacting with them, because they are constantly scrutinising your body language and your facial expressions to see whether what they're saying pushes any kinds of emotional buttons, it seems that because of years and years of innate ability to study facial expressions, they're able to perceive these lightning-fast faces in changes in facial scenery way better than the rest of us are. The only group, incidentally, who can give psychopaths a run for their money in this is elite meditative Buddhist monks who live high up in the Himalayas for what we think are completely different reasons. Through years of meditation and also martial arts training, they're able to slow down their perceptual processes to see these kinds of lightning fast changes in real time, to what we call in the trade thin slice. And I've actually in the middle of running an experiment at the moment comparing psychopaths and these elite Buddhist meditative martial arts monks in the Himalayas on a test of truth detection. And I tell you, actually, I've been up to the Himalayas several times now, and you need to be a bit of a psychopath to get up there, actually, because there are sheer drops high above the snow lines. And these monks are pretty amazing, just living up in the high forest in remote shacks. Let me tell you about the experiment that I'm running with some colleagues at the University of British Columbia in Canada. Everyone familiar, of course, with the McCann case, right? Disappearance of Madeleine McCann. Well, what happens when somebody disappears, especially a child, but it could be anyone, is sometimes the police will put the relatives of the person who's disappeared on television to plead for the whereabouts of that particular person, as happened in the McCann case. Now, in the vast majority of cases, we know that the person who is pleading for information is genuinely pleading for information. Okay, they genuinely do not know what has happened to that person. But there are a minority of cases where the pleaders are actually the perpetrators of the crime. So what we did, what we're doing, is we got 20 pleader video clips, and 10 of which are true, 10 of which are false. And we played them to, we're playing them to a bunch of psychopaths and to these monks high up in the Himalayas. And it's a very simple question: who's telling the truth and who's lying? The working title of the study at the moment is Monks versus Punks. But we're already run into a bit of trouble with Oxford University Ethics Committee for calling it that, so we probably won't be able to get away with it. What we're going to do, I'm just going to finish off, folks. We can do three. We're going to finish off with three of these pleader clips, and we're going to see how good you guys are. Now, I always do this absolutely randomly, so I want someone to shout out a number between 1 and 20.
19.
Okay, this guy is talking about his wife, okay?
I would like to just ask if there is anyone in the public who might have any information, no matter how small, that then may be able to help the police.
Okay, thanks. On the count of three, I want you to put your hands up if you think this guy is guilty and he's killed his wife himself. Oh my God. You were all nice when I started. Okay, that's pretty much all of you, I think. How many people think he's innocent? Few takers. Okay, let's see what our survey says. Guilty. Killed his wife, serving a life sentence. How many people got that right? Stick your hands up again. Pretty much all of you. Okay, let's do another one. Another random number between 1 and 20, not 2. 3. All right. Another guy talking about his wife, actually.
She back. Kids need you back. I need you back. Please get in touch. Please let us know where she is. And best. If the kids have made banners for you, cards for you, and you love them.
Okay, folks, count three. Count of three. How many people think he is guilty and has killed his wife? My God. You're all on the turn. How many people think he is innocent? A few more than before. Okay, let's see what our survey says. Guilty. Another guy serving a life sentence. How many people got 2 out of 2? Not bad. Okay, one more random number between 1 and 20, not 2 or 3.
8.
My heart is already sinking when I hear number 8. We've got to do it randomly. This time it's a woman talking about her husband.
Somebody somewhere knows who did this. My husband Eric did not deserve this. As a frail man, any resistance could easily have been overcome by these two young men.
Well, we've got to do it randomly, folks. All right, how many people think she's guilty? Oh, my God. How many people think she's innocent? That's better. Let's see what our survey says. Sorts the men out from the boys, doesn't it? Chopped him up, poisoned him and chopped him up, serving a life sentence. Thank you very much, whoever said number 8. It's great. How many people got 3 out of 3? Well done. Well done, very good. We could do all 20, we won't do it. Folks, I'm going to leave it there. I just want to say thank you very much for listening to me. I don't know whether you are a psychopath. I don't know whether the person sitting next to you is a psychopath, your best friend or your bank manager or whoever is a psychopath. But I'll tell you something.